Hi, welcome to Dig Into China. I'm Dong Xiong reporting from Washington, D.C. As America becomes more diversified and in some locations, the majority becomes just another minority. Understanding what's important in the minds of minority voters becomes crucial in order to maintain and build their loyalties. Asian Americans are the fastest growing population in the nation. Between 1990 and 2000, the Asian American population grew by 48.3%, more than three times the growth rate of 13.2% for the total national population. The increase in social awareness, combined with strength in numbers, has changed the political scene in many states. Even though Asian Americans make up just 4% of the U.S. population, in a close race whose result is decided by a small margin, Asian Americans can play an important role. I'm joined today by Christine Chen, Executive Director at APIA Vote. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, my first question is, there are about 8 million voting age Asian Americans in this country, but only 3.5 million are registered voters. And why is that?
Well, a lot of the Asian American organizations and within our community leaders have not really talked about the importance of voting. So that's not part of our tradition in terms of becoming citizens and then registering to vote and, and actually voting.
Mm-hmm. Well, my impression is I thought a lot of Asian American will love to vote. For myself as example is, you know, I'm from China. I never had a chance to vote in my own country. So when I came here, I become a citizen. The first thing I do is register myself as a voter, and I just vote every single time that I had a chance afterwards. And I read some articles and I see some TV news. They talk about new immigrants. They have very high voter turnouts. And the Asian American here is only 3.5 million are registered out of 8 million voting age population. Is that because they are not citizens or they are not allowed to vote?
Right. Well, out of 12 million Asian Pacific Islander population, you know, only 6.7 are 18 years and older and are U.S. citizens.
I see.
And then 3.5 million are actually registered. So where we really need to focus on is actually registering our community. In reality, voting is very new for our community. It was only 1952 with the Warren-McCarran Act immigration law change where Asian immigrants were finally allowed to become U.S. citizens and to actually go ahead and vote.
Now, out of those 3.5 million Asian American voters, how many of them actually vote in 2006 midterm election? Do you have any numbers on that?
We don't have the numbers yet for 2006, but in 2004, we nearly had about 3 million who actually voted. So we're comparable in terms of with the African American and Latino community in terms of turning out. But where we need to work on is really sending the message that we need to register. And a lot of it is that we need to have the infrastructure and capacity to actually get the message out, because we haven't been doing that effectively.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that Asian American make a lot of headways and play a very important role in America, this country's election, because many races are so close?
Right. Well, we made a lot of headway, especially this past November. We've had an increase of Asian Americans run for office and win. And every time we have an Asian American run for office, that means more Asian Americans are engaged in the process and taking interest in elections. But also because elections are very close, for instance, like in Virginia, where the population is 3% are Asian American, and the race was for governor, I mean, for senator was actually won by 1%, that we could actually make a difference.
Now, I read some reports that released by Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and they released a report about this 2006 midterm election. Mm-hmm. And based on the exit polls, the Asian American are overwhelmingly in favor of Democrats. Take for Virginia, for example, 76% voted for Jim Webb, Democrat, 21% for George Allen, Republican. And in New Jersey, 77% for incumbent Senator Robert Menendez and 20% vote for Republican challenger Tom Kaine. Maryland, 73% Democrat, 24% for the Republican, so on and so forth with Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. And take a look at this Illinois gubernatorial race, 99% vote for Democratic. Mm-hmm. Now, why Asian Americans are so in favor of a Democrat Party?
Well, I think it has changed throughout the last 10 years. It started out in 1996 when a lot of the issues around welfare reform and immigration reform, the Democrats were a lot better about listening to the Asian American community and taking the advice of how we wanted the policy to be changed. And also, I think the Democrats, especially with Congressman Mike Honda being the vice chair of the DNC, he's made a lot of effort to get the DNC to actually do a lot of outreach to the Asian American community, where they've translated a lot more materials and gotten candidates to actually visit with the community leaders. I know, for instance, in the Virginia race, Webb did a lot of that, and they actually had a community of volunteers working on that race. Senator Allen did do some outreach to the Asian American community, but in comparison to the efforts that were done by the Webb campaign, they did tremendously a lot more.
Now, do you think actually the racial comments about the Makaka thing hurt him a lot for him in Virginia? Because before that incident, he enjoyed a very wide lead against Jim Webb. But all of a sudden, after that, he just, kind of dragging behind and behind. And do you think, is that because Asian American is playing a role here?
That was a large turning point. I think it upset a lot of Asian Americans as well as immigrants mm-hmm. with the whole idea that, just because we're immigrant, that we're not real Virginian. That really upset a lot mm-hmm. of the communities here, especially in Northern Virginia.
Mm. Now, do you think, when we talk about Asian American and actually, Asian American consists of many different small and different subgroups. There we have like Indians, we have Chinese, we have Vietnamese, and Philippines. And is there a difference between different Asian American groups that their preference are different? For example, is that true that Indians and Chinese are in favor of Democratic, and the Vietnamese and the Philippines are in favor of Republican?
Right. It does vary among the different ethnic groups, but it also differs between generations. Mm. So if you're a first generation immigrant Vietnamese American, it may differ for a second generation Vietnamese American who may be more Democratic leaning. So it really depends on the issues that resonate with a specific population. So I think for the Asian American community, we're not necessarily wedded in terms of Democrat or Republican. It's really about the candidates and how they stand on specific issues, and that's how they'll put their weight behind a candidate.
Now, give me a few examples, like for the older generation and younger generation, they're different. So what are the issues that older generations care about, and what's the younger generation are so different with their parents?
Well, I think, issues of immigration still may be a larger issue with the first generation immigrants because they're trying to reunite with their family members. And it's still very much that whole process of going through immigration is still very much a big issue with them. For second generation Asians, they may be thinking about how are they going to get access higher education? Are they going to be able to pay off their loans? Are you putting enough funding into Asian American studies programs on the college level? So, their interests may be a little bit different. Just like also healthcare. Healthcare access may differ between first generation immigrants mm-hmm. versus second generation, a 19 or 20 year old. So, that's how, depending on the issues that are being talked about.
Mm. Now, tell us about APIA Vote organization that you are the executive director, and what kind of effort you have put in forward to try to get more Asian Americans get registered.
Well, Asian Pacific Islander American Vote, APIA Vote, is a national organization focusing on increasing civic participation among our community. And it's actually been a project among national Asian American groups for the last 10 years, and we just recently incorporated this past December. But with that, the whole idea is that we want to train Asian American leaders, community-based organizations, to actually incorporate voter registration, education, and get out the vote activities into their program and their network. And as a result, to actually build the capacity so that way we could continue to educate our community and ensure that they actually get their voice heard at the polling place. But actually, civic participation doesn't just stop there. It also continues after Election Day. So starting in January, February, a lot of the civil rights organizations are going to want to have Asian American voters voice their opinion about how they feel about immigration reform and what are we going to do about racial profiling issues.
Now, compared to other ethnic groups, like especially compared to Latinos and Asian, is a smaller in number. And do you think Asian Americans, they are quite united on those issues, or they are quite diversified? Because in Asian country and Asian people are quite diversified here.
Right. Well, I think for issues like immigration, that is one area, as well as hate crimes and racial profiling. Those are three areas where a lot of the Asian American community does unite around. For other issues like affirmative action, that may really differ. But that's something where what we're trying to actually research a lot more, because there's not enough being done understanding about the Asian American voter community.
I see. So in the future, you know, from 5 or 10 years from now, what do you see the future for the Asian Americans, that they are going to play a larger role here because the population increase? Let me ask you differently, though. Asian American usually they reside in the large metropolitan areas like in New York, California, but they are not very spread all over the places. And do you think that plays an advantage or disadvantage of the future role of Asian American in U.S. political scene?
I think with API Vote, we're actually focusing on those communities that have been moving away from just the West Coast and the East Coast. Ever since 2000, we've seen Asian Americans move into areas like Texas, Georgia, Ohio, Minnesota, and those different areas. So we're actually working with nonprofit leaders and community organizations to actually build their capacity to ensure that their voice is being heard in those communities. In Minnesota, we have a large Hmong community that is actually now known to where elected officials are trying to cater to their vote, to get their vote. So the same way with in Houston, Texas, we had a Vietnamese American run for state assembly and actually won, Hubert Vo. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that these other areas are building the capacity. And then also this past November election, we also saw state assembly members win who are Asian in Ohio, Kansas, in Idaho. These are areas that you traditionally don't think that Asian Americans reside in.
Well, Christine, thank you very much. Appreciate it coming on the show.
Great, thank you.
Coming up next, how to deal with a rising China. Stay tuned. Thank you for watching Digging to China. With rapid growth in the economy as well as growth in trade and investment in Asia, China is no doubt a rising power in the region. China's diplomacy involves leadership meetings and agreements with other countries, as well as increasing Chinese cultural interchange with a growing number of organizations. China is on its way to becoming a regional power. Does China pose a challenge to the United States from a diplomatic, economic, and military standpoint? As Asia's security guarantor and vital economic power, how can the U.S. deal with a rising China? I discussed this topic with Doug Bendel, Vice President of Policy for Citizen Outreach. Let's play the clip. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be on.
I know that you just come back from China. Tell us about your trip.
Well, last month I was in Shenyang, which is in the northeast, and once was known as kind of the Rust Belt of China, but a very vibrant city. I was quite impressed. I was there the previous year as well, and you can tell that growth has gone out not only to Beijing and Shanghai, but is reaching well beyond.
As I know, the Shenyang is in the northeast part. It used to be the heavy industry there, and it's pretty good, revibrating again.
Well, certainly Shenyang seemed like a very vibrant city, very modern, a lot of economic activity, very clean. So it struck me that, at least it looked to me, just in visiting a few days, that this is a city that also has some good economic growth and potential for the future.
I read some article about you right after you come back from China. You describe a great deal about the Great Wall, a Great Wall information on the information technology there. And tell us about that.
Well, I was there 3 or 4 years ago, and it was very interesting. I would get online. I could get online and get my email, but I was not able to get onto actually the web itself, which was very unusual. I could get onto AOL, but it was very hard for me to reach any websites. This last time, I was there in July and August as well as September. I could get on to most websites, but I couldn't get on to any blogs, because I normally blog and have a couple of blogs I contribute to. And it's well known that the Chinese government has created what people often call the firewall of China. And you could find that there were just some sites you couldn't get to. Most of the internet was wide open, but there were some limitations, including the government is still trying to, you know, control to some degree access.
So you are saying you can get to most of the website, not blogs. So you can get like a CNN, Fox News, or Voice America, BBC. So
you can you can't get to, for example, Western human rights organizations. And I've been told that, say, the BBC, you know, particular news organizations may be blocked if they have some critical articles at a particular time. But over the course of most time, you can get onto most of the news websites. So it's kind of an interesting. I tried some of the conservative websites. Mm-hmm. Conservative publications in the United States, and I was able to get onto them as well.
Are these information censored, or you see 100% as you can see in this country?
As far as I could tell, once I got on the websites, I could see everything that I wanted. Now, Google has created a Google China, which my understanding is, in fact, there are limitations. The searches you can make on Google China are more limited than the searches you would make on Google in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a more generic question, though, about this this different method or different level of degree that you can access in this country and in China. For example, in this country, we have about 100,000 Chinese students studying here, and they are not restricted for most of the information, and they can have access to a lot of information. And in China, there are not that many American students. Even if they are, they don't have access for a lot of sensitive information. On the one hand is, for example, in China, there are hundreds of prominent American people who know a lot about China, and they are pro-Beijing, and they publicly critical of the Bush's administration's policy towards China. That's okay, that's their rights. But in China, there is no such a community that people are pro-American, and they are criticize China's policy towards Americans. So that is not fair. Do you see? Do you agree with me? It's kind of a we are very open here, but in China it's not that open. So there with China has certain degree of advantage. Don't you agree that?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think China is coming out of a very authoritarian past. So criticism of the government has always, been forbidden in the past. So that's kind of a carryover. So I think you're right. There is kind of a disproportion there. It's obvious that it's easy for Americans to be critical of their own government, whether they're in America or if they're in another country. It's much more difficult for somebody who's Chinese, at least if they want to go back to China, to be critical of their own government because their future is going to be controlled by the Chinese government.
Well, my question is, can it be very dangerous? Because Chinese people, they don't know what they cannot hear, and they don't know how much they cannot hear. So what they get is what they get from the medias, and they probably will come up with the wrong judgment. That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, one of the problems with the kind of censorship we've seen in China is that in certain ways, the problem is, from that standpoint, the internet may be too free. That is, it's not real obvious that you're being censored. So I suspect there are a number of Chinese who would be getting onto the internet who wouldn't be aware that they aren't getting some things. And I think you're right. There's a danger if you don't understand the other side, you don't understand the real issues, that you may very well come up with bad judgments. And in terms of the future of U.S.-Chinese relations, that'd be harmful to both sides.
No, correct. Now, let me ask you this pretty much the same question in a different angle. Do you believe the authoritarian China has an advantage over U.S.? For example, they can hide their plan they don't want to reveal, and they can pull the string of their public opinions, and they can gain access to the American society while closing door within China. So when you deal with China in the world stage, U.S. kind of has a lot of disadvantage. Do you agree?
Well, I think there are certain ways in which authoritarian states have, I suppose, an advantage over democratic ones. But I do think that the openness of democratic society and the support that citizens typically give that, there are advantages to that as well. So I would agree, in dealing with China, one has to be very aware. For example, military spending. The U.S. is far more transparent in military spending than China is. It's a lot easier for China as an authoritarian government to hide things. But they've been criticized in international fora over that, and people are aware of it. So I think what we need to do in the West and countries that deal with China is be aware of those areas and hold China accountable and recognize that we won't get everything. We won't see everything that we should see. We have to take that into account because, in that sense, closed societies have some advantages, but they have some disadvantages too.
Like what?
Well, I think that a society that's open, I think, is likely to be more stable. That there's a danger, for example, of a closed society holding things in, not letting people express themselves and have those avenues of dissatisfaction. China's finding that today with a lot of social unrest, problems in the rural areas, protests that they try to cover up. I think that makes it more dangerous for them because they're not allowing people a normal process of expressing dissatisfaction.
Now, you've written a lot of articles about the security and the economics in Asia. Now, right now, North Korea is a thorny issue right now, and the entire world is watching China because China is the biggest provider of their energies. If China can pull the lifeline, North Korea will at least listen. So do you think China this time will play an active role? Because North Korea is, I would say like this, China create a monster that they cannot control. Is that a true statement?
Well, certainly I think the problem is that so far China has looked at North Korea and I think they fear a collapse of North Korea more than they fear a nuclear weapon in North Korea. And that's the problem. So China has always been very wary about sanctions, very wary about putting too much pressure on North Korea. They seem more offended now. They urged North Korea not to test missiles back in July. They urged the North Koreans not to test a nuclear weapon. You can see in the comments of the UN ambassador and others, they seem genuinely offended. But so far, when they've talked about sanctions, they said they want to keep it narrow. It should be tied to military. I still see a caution in China. And I think that's the real tension that the U.S. and other countries need to make very clear to China, that this is an issue of enormous importance in terms of regional stability. And that's something that should concern China, too. And my personal view is that what the U.S. should basically tell China, privately but clearly, is if the North Korean nuclear weapon sets off a chain reaction, where a South Korea starts thinking about getting nuclear weapons, a Japan thinks about getting nuclear weapons, that the U.S. might not stop that. It might not interrupt that. That China has to understand that there could be a nightmare here from China's standpoint, that this is a moment for all countries to work together.
Now, let me say this. I have a proposal. You can stop me if it's too crazy. Do you think it's a good strategy for the U.S. to approach China, say, okay, here is the deal. You help us to change the regime of Kim Jong-il regime. And in return, and of course, there's going to be a united Korea in return that we will retreat from Korea Peninsula and China, you can be the regional power. Am I crazy here?
Well, I think there's a good reason to pull U.S. troops out of South Korea anyway. I mean, there's a conventional defense. South Korea doesn't need them. I think given China's fear of having a united Korea on its border allied with the U.S., I think it makes a lot of sense to tell the Chinese, we still want to be friends with the United Korea, whether South Korea, United Korea, North Korea, whatever they are. We want to have relations with them. But if you help us and try to get rid of this regime, we're not going to be there trying to create a client state of the United States on your border. I think that would be a fair deal to work out. I think it would be private assurances. I think the U.S. could bring some more of its troops home to indicate that. I think that makes a lot of sense. We're asking the Chinese to do a lot. I mean, this has been an allied state for 50 years. If we're asking them to try to engineer an overthrow or put a lot of a pressure on that government, we can expect we'll ask something in return, and I think we should be prepared to give something.
Now, the other thing is, for many Chinese people, they believe that United States' ultimate goal is to stop China to be a power, a world power, or stop China to become even a regional power. They would argue like U.S. is in alliance with Japan, South Korea, and may get better relationship with Vietnam. Of course, proving the relationship with India. Looks like they are surrounding China by having a good relationship with neighbors. Do you see that is the strategy for the U.S. administration?
Well, I think it's probably too much credit to give the administration to believe they have a coordinated strategy right now. I mean, this is an administration that is tied up and focused on the Middle East. I don't think they have thought a lot about kind of really how to make Asia work, what American policy should be. I think there are, though, forces in American society who'd like to have containment of China. I mean, there are some forces among conservatives, I think, who view that as being the ultimate goal. There are a lot of people who don't agree with that. And I think what China has to understand is there's a real debate in U.S. society. People who are concerned about human rights, some are concerned about trade, some are concerned about military buildup. All of those forces are kind of fighting with one another. And that the way China reacts will have an impact on how that debate plays out. And my hope is to avoid the idea of containment. I think that if you treat a country as an enemy, you're far more likely to have them as an enemy. That we want good relations. On the other hand, I think it makes sense to say that a South Korea, a Japan, and others need to make their own judgments about China's intentions. You know, and if Japan wants to take a more active military role, I don't think it's America's job to stop it. That's something where we want good relations between Tokyo and Beijing, but that's going to ultimately be up to China and Japan.
So U.S. should be happy when Shinzo Abe visits China as his first overseas visit.
Absolutely. I think that almost everyone in the region was concerned about how Japan's relations with both South Korea and China had deteriorated. I think the fact that he went to China first was a very important step to try to help improve relations, kind of calm down, you know, those tensions. So that, I think, was a very good step.
Now, my last question to you is, we exchange a few emails, and usually on the end of the email, you have a quotation like this. Let me quote that. It said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." Can you apply that to the U.S. dealing with China? You have 1 minute.
I think that I believe that very much, but I also believe in prudence. Mm-hmm. And in dealing with a country like China, the U.S. should stand up for human rights and freedom. But we should also look long term in terms of how we can achieve that for a better future for Americans and Chinese. So I would apply prudence as well as the pursuit of justice and liberty.
So in other words, prudence means we can adopt a certain pragmatic approach while holding our principle.
Absolutely.
But how do you define that?
Well, the question is what works.
Red line.
How do we create peace as well as a positive relationship? And I think that's the challenge for the statesman. And it's not easy. Looking ahead, both Chinese and Americans are going to have to work this coming century, you know, to make sure that relationship is a peaceful and a prosperous one.
Very well said. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please tell us what you think about our show and let us know what you want to discuss about China. Please email us your comments from anywhere in the world. The email address is comments@diggingtochina.org. Thank you for watching. I'm Dong Xiong, and I hope to see you next time. Remember, by working hard, we can and we will eventually dig to China together.